What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
And we open up and welcome you into Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. The Legal Eagles are here in studio, the band back together, Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside. My name is Sam Panionovich. We will start talking some IHSA football. We'll also get into legal marijuana. How does that weigh into the presidential administration with Donald Trump? The Obama overtime rule has been blocked. And then, of course, the legal grab bag at the end. But we start with Craig Anderson, who's the IHSA executive director. And, Craig, you've been busy recently because of the outcome of Plainfield North and Fenwick. Before we get started, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Craig, yeah, tell us about, first of all, IHSA is Illinois High School Association. That's the governing board for high school athletics here in the state. In the news lately was a lawsuit brought by Fenwick High School seeking to reverse a Plainfield North High School victory. These are two high schools here in Chicagoland area. They were asking a judge to overturn what happened on the field. Take it from there. Explain to our listeners what this is all about.
Yeah, well, it was certainly a tough deal in a semifinal game that was very tightly matched. Two teams, very good teams, obviously, to make it to the semifinals. And there was a call at the end of regulation, and an appropriate call, by all accounts, of an intentional grounding penalty.
You said appropriate or inappropriate?
No, it was an appropriate call.
Got it, okay.
The call was correct that they needed to flag and penalize the team for intentional grounding. What ensued after that, in my opinion, what became an enforcement of the penalty error was troublesome for us in regards to, you know, what it did to the outcome of the game. But so what happened in that particular penalty, while it was an accurate call, the enforcement of which, because time ran out during that down, the Federation rules book would say that when a penalty has as part of its enforcement a loss of down, that there's no extending of the period for one untimed down like there may be with other penalties that are accepted. So while the Federation rules book indicates that that's the way it should be, the officiating crew enforced differently and allowed one additional untimed down. And because it was the fourth down, the untimed down made it a first down for Plainfield North in this case. They were able to kick a field goal, tie the game. The game went into overtime, and Plainfield North won. So while the call itself was accurate, the enforcement of the penalty was where we found ourselves in error, the officiating crew in this case. And that resulted in, while Plainfield North eventually won the game, there was controversy, obviously, because had it been ruled accurately by the officiating crew, the game would have ended with that penalty as part of the enforcement.
All right, and then NIHSA, there's no cameras, obviously, that can look at the review. What options did Fenwick have to challenge this ruling other than the court system? Were there any options available?
Well, not according to our bylaws. So what we get into here is once the game is complete, obviously during the game they could have, the coach, and maybe he did, I'm not aware if he did, but he could have called for a conference with the crew to try to get their ruling on the play and see if, you know, they could discover the accurate. But my understanding is, you know, they let the game play on, and then after the game was over, we came to realize that the error was made by the officiating crew. But once the game is completed, then we have a set of bylaws that our membership has agreed to, one of which says that decisions of game officials are final and our board of directors do not take appeals of the decisions of game officials. So because of that bylaw, and once the game was completed, our board of directors you know, which they oversee me and my role here as executive director. Both of us, neither one of us, had the opportunity to overturn the outcome of the game, which would have meant we would have had to overturn the decision of the game officials, even though their enforcement penalty was in error.
Okay, and then Fenwick hired an attorney, filed an injunction, and then walk us through what happened.
Yeah, certainly. So they filed requested of the judge, a TRO, try to file an injunction to get the outcome of the game reversed, basically. And so on Wednesday morning of last week, you know, we went to court and, you know, they obviously positioned themselves in regards to their belief that the game was over when the clock went to zero. And by Federation rule, the rules book indicated the game was over. They argued that, you know, the officials didn't have any future involvement in the game at that point, even though they didn't declare the game final. And the rules book would say that the officials, in fact, do declare when the game has been completed. And as a result, the game played on and we had a different outcome.
And the judge, this is Kathleen Kennedy here in Cook County in Chicago. The judge denied the motion or denied the relief that Fenwick was seeking, basically saying that the decision is final, that, you know, in so many words, this was a football game. You know, I think everyone stipulates that there was an error, but the judge ruled that, you know, that decision was made. There's no ability to seek court relief for it, and she rejected that argument. Were you there for the hearing?
I was there for the hearing, yes.
Did the judge explain her decision? And also, you know, sometimes judges will just write an order. Sometimes they won't explain things. How did the judge, what was her response like?
Yeah, she did present an oral response. And we may get something in writing also, though I haven't received that yet. But generally her response, in my opinion, was that, you know, Fenwick, like all of our member schools, agree to be members of our association. They do that at their own initiative. We don't require that high schools become members of our association. So as a volunteer member, they also agreed to abide by the rules that our association has determined they would govern themselves, which are our bylaws, one of which is the bylaw 6.033 that I mentioned earlier about the decision of game officials being final. So her opinion was, since Fenwick had enjoined themselves with our association and agreed to, as a member, to abide by our bylaws, they, you know, because of their volunteer being a part of that, that she didn't have a position to go in and interfere with what, you know, their position as a member of our association have agreed to abide by.
We're talking with Craig Anderson. He's the IHSA executive director. He's with us on Legal Faceoff. You said the call on the field was right, but the enforcement was wrong. And I saw you issued a statement already. But if you had a chance or an opportunity to speak to some of these Fenwick players who had their season ended on something that we can all agree was the wrong thing, what would you tell them? How would you explain it to them?
Well, obviously that would be a difficult position to be in. And that, you know, throughout these days and continuing past even as we finish our state finals, you know, it's difficult for me even to reflect as a former player, former coach, to think about, you know, what that feels like, you know, when you lose fair and square, even at that position in their season, that's difficult to understand. You know, to lose a close game, I'll say, with correct calls or correct enforcement, you know, those are difficult. But to know that, you know, it was within your grasp, you know, it's a terrible position to be in. And I hope that my statements that have been presented reflect that, because I continue to be troubled, like those players likely are and will be for, you know, days and months and possibly years to come by, you know, the always what could have been. And I think in sports, we always think about what could have been and what, you know, had we done this or that differently. And I'm sure Coach Nudo was thinking, you know, the same thing, some things he could have done.
Craig, but, let me jump in. As you probably know, there's, from a legal perspective, there's no precedence for, in Illinois at least, for a high school event outcome to be interfered with by the court. There was a case in Oklahoma from 2014 where a high school tried to have a game replayed after an official made a mistake, similar to this case. The judge in that case said that it was a slippery slope, could lead to future litigation, so they denied the relief in that case. You know, we're, Jason and I are often in the position on this show of advocating for lawyers taking these kind of cases because, you know, as lawyers ourselves, not just because we want to take cases, but we believe in the judicial system as a proper venue for a lot of disputes. Personally, from my perspective, in this case, though, I think the court got it right. You know, as a former player, we all played sports in this room. You know, I think that these things should be decided on the field. And human error is part of the game. You know, unfortunately, there's no replay. There's no other provision in this situation to remedy it. So, you know, human error is what it is. In this case, it had a, you know, fairly significant effect because of the level that this game was at. But, you know, I don't think that I think if the judge would have granted the relief, you'd have every school who lost a game, you know, seeking legal relief. Jason will maybe take the opposite position.
No, he
loves taking cases to court.
No, as much as I love litigation, too, I honestly think, I mean, a football game never comes down to one play. You know, there's all multiple plays beforehand that, you know, could have changed the outcome of the game. They could have, you know, scored additional points. I mean, that's why, you know, there's certain coaches. I mean, Mike Ditka has a famous phrase about, you know, just pounding the ball and running up the score for instances like this. But, yeah, I mean, I don't agree with taking this sort of thing to court because I think it sets a bad example for students, too, that in this situation there's a winner and a loser. And that's pretty much the way life works. So, you know, unfortunately, like Rich said, there is a human error element to it, and it's uncontrollable.
Yeah, I would agree with you both. You know, I also understand on Fenwick's behalf how they believe they needed to do what was in the best interest of their students and their program and, you know, in the Fenwick community. But your points are exactly right, you know, and that's what I would get to, hopefully, if I got to speak with the players was, you know, there's some life lessons to be learned here. Sometimes life isn't fair. You know, there are mistakes made, and a mistake was made here. You know, I make mistakes in my job. You know, we're going to all make mistakes at some point in our life. And like you said, there are mistakes made in the game. There's enforcement errors made. This just happened to be a critical one at a really critical point in the game.
Well, you've handled it the right way, Craig. Keep up the good work with the IHSA. Thanks for joining us. And hopefully we can avoid things like this down the road. Take care.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Craig Anderson. He's the IHSA Executive Director on Legal Faceoff.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Faceoff. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Be sure to listen to Legal Faceoff on iTunes. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Rate, review, and share with a friend. It's Rich and Jason on Legal Faceoff, WGN Plus. Our next guest is Troy Dayton, who's the CEO of the ArcView Group out in California. He also serves on the boards for the Marijuana Policy Project and the National Cannabis Industry Association. Also co-founded Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and he joins us now on WGN. Hello, Troy.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Troy, thanks for joining us. We're talking today about how legal marijuana will look in a Trump administration. The recent election had California and three other states join Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Alaska in legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. Yet it's still illegal federally. So do you think that that will change under a Trump administration? I know that on the stump when he was running for president in Nevada, for example, Trump said, I think medical should happen. Don't we agree? I mean, I think so. And then I really think you should leave it up to the states. It should be a state situation. So first question off the bat is, do more states allow recreational marijuana under President Trump?
Well, I think that this is a hugely popular issue. I mean, we're at 60% public support nationwide and even more so in many states. And so I think that states will continue to pass legalization laws, much as they passed medical laws when there was an unfriendly administration. But the question as to whether this is, will be an unfriendly administration or not to the cannabis issue is really a question mark. I mean, all evidence that we have so far would suggest that it is going to be positive to the cannabis issue. As you mentioned, Donald Trump has been completely consistent on the campaign trail that he thinks this is a state's issue, and he's even said very positive things about medical cannabis. And so why would he go back on a campaign promise on a hugely popular issue, especially with the Justice Department that's going to have a whole lot more bigger fish to fry than the cannabis issue.
So when you say friendly, let's break that down, because I didn't know about this Cole memo before I started doing some research on this. I think most listeners don't realize that, again, marijuana remains illegal under federal law. There's a 2013 policy memo under the Obama administration under the current Justice Department when then Deputy Attorney General James Cole says that if states make effective efforts to keep cannabis away from kids, prevent driving while under the influence of marijuana, and some other concerns, then basically the federal government will look the other way and will let states that legalize recreational marijuana continue to do so, even though it does technically violate federal law. So that's what we're talking about, the push and pull between federal and state law, correct?
Yes, yes. So this is the Cole memo is one thing that is in place that is currently protecting states. There's another thing that's in place, which is that there's an amendment to the appropriations bill that was passed that bars the Department of Justice from spending any taxpayer money to undermine state medical marijuana laws. And so that is up for renewal here fairly soon. And then there's also a big push to extend that to cover legal marijuana businesses, you know, the adult use legalization states as well. And so, you know, Trump recently announced Jeff Sessions as the attorney general. And Jeff Sessions is pretty much the most ardent cannabis opponent in the Senate. So it's not a good choice for us. And so the big question is going to be, will Jeff Sessions' belief about cannabis rule the day, or will Trump's belief and politics of the issue rule the day? It is our hope that the latter will be the case.
And Troy, let's jump in on that too with Jeff Sessions, because he's come out pretty vocal against marijuana. He has some statements that you know, we've read online. He claims it's a gateway drug, that good people don't smoke marijuana. How much enforcement power will Jeff Sessions as the attorney general have with the marijuana enforcement?
Well, the Justice Department has limited resources. Almost all drug arrests happen at the state level. Something like 99% happen at the state level. And so when the federal government does get involved, they really need local support to be effective and to be cost effective. But they're not going to get local support in the 28 states that have passed some form of medical or adult use legalization. And so it's really a resources question for the Justice Department. And so there really isn't the kind of resources to kind of go after this. That being said, you know, they could easily send shockwaves of just like Obama did earlier in his administration, where they just sent a few letters out, and you know, that caused a big stir in the cannabis industry. So there's a lot that can be done with the postage stamp, and that's what's difficult about this.
But to your point, I mean, it seems like, you know, overwhelmingly, or you know, to a large degree, this is the trend. You know, the trend is towards legalizing recreational marijuana. You know, 3 in 5 Americans approximately now live in a state with some sort of legal cannabis. It's a $7 billion industry and growing. As we mentioned, there's 3 or 4 new states now that legalize recreational marijuana, including the most populous state being California. And the industry is projected to approach $22 billion by 2020. So I say all that, to underline your point that would Trump, as a new president, really want to expend political capital on something that seems pretty popular? And would he want to, you know, would Sessions want to make that one of his, you know, main early platforms as attorney general?
Yeah, I think it would be political suicide for them to go after such a hugely popular issue that's not just popular generally, but is also popular among their demographics, among the demographics that put Trump in office. So if you look at Florida, you look at North Dakota, you look at Montana, and you look at Arkansas, all passed their measures, their medical cannabis measures, by huge margins and also went to Trump. So in all of these cases, the cannabis got more votes than Trump did. So this is clearly popular among conservatives in red states. And so this would just be crazy to go against that. And by the way, I think this is a huge opportunity for the Republicans to take this issue from the Democrats. They've got both houses and the presidency, and this is a hugely popular issue. And they can take it away from the Dems if they really grab it. I think it'd be hugely popular.
Troy, we'd be remiss if we didn't get you out of here with one last question. What's your reaction? I'm sure you have had, and you know, as your organization, you probably have had an official reaction. But what's your reaction to the recent study that showed that marijuana users have abnormally low blood flow in every part of their brain? What's your thoughts on that study that was just, I think, released?
I have not looked at that, so I couldn't comment. But what I will say is that the government has spent tens of millions of dollars over the years trying to show that cannabis is super harmful and, you know, all of these things, and they just haven't been able to show that. I mean, we all know lots of people that have consumed cannabis for many, many years, and they're fine. And so either way, regardless, this is certainly a safer substance than alcohol, and it certainly falls in the realm of the kind of thing that adults can decide on in a free society.
Last question, Troy. Currently, there's legislation in 26 states and the District of Columbia that has legalized marijuana in some form. Do you see a day when all the states are on board and that every state is green?
Well, one thing's for sure. I'm not going to stop fighting until there's not a single adult punished for this plant anywhere in the entire world. But what do I think is politically likely? I think that in somewhere between 2020 and 2021, I believe Congress will pass a law that repeals federal prohibition and lets the states decide, which would mean that some states would go legal and other states would continue their prohibitions. But I do think that maybe over time that it would grow and there would actually be, you know, either a Supreme Court case or a federal law change that actually required a certain amount of privacy in one's own home to be able to cultivate a few plants or something like that. So that's what I think is likely, but I don't think that's likely to happen in the short run. That's more of a long-term thing.
That's Troy Dayton. He's the CEO of the ArcView Group, arcviewgroup.com. Thank you so much for your time here in Chicago.
Thanks for having me.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
our final guest on this episode of Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus with Rich Lightcoff and Jason Whiteside. You know her. She's been on the show before. Returning guest to Legal Face-Off, Maytal Savin, who's a labor and employment attorney at, look at this, Bryce Downey and Lightcoff. Welcome back, Maytal.
Thanks for having me again.
I think I've heard of them. It's funny how...
Have you heard of her?
Yes, both. Hey, Maytal, tell us about the overtime, the new overtime law, and why it's in the news.
Sure. So there's been a lot of news about this. But I think before we get into the recent court decision, we have to back up just a few steps and explain to our listeners a little bit about what the Fair Labor Standards Act is and how it implicates overtime and what employers are going to be doing now. So the Fair Labor Standards Act, or the FLSA, basically requires minimum wage and overtime for all employees. There are certain exemptions for what we know as the white-collar exemption, and those require that employees be paid on a salary basis, that they meet a certain salary threshold, and that they meet a certain job duties test. Now, the FLSA was promulgated by Congress, but they delegated their authority to the Department of Labor to define what those criteria are for the exemption we just discussed. And really, the heart of the decision that just came down has to do with the salary threshold. The regulations that were scheduled to go into effect on December 1st would increase the salary threshold from $455 a week, or that's roughly $23,000 a year, to $913 a week, which equates to about $47,000 a year for the overtime exemption to kick in.
And Maytal, sorry to interrupt you, but you know, we we looked at this too. I mean, as a small employer, we obviously have a lot of employees, a few that would qualify for this. How many people did this estimate it would affect on December 1st?
By the way, Whiteside, when he says he looked at it, he tried to get he tried to enact legislation to pay his employees.
I sent it to Rich.
Rates from the 1940s.
Yeah, so this, if this had gone into effect, it would have extended to over 4 million Americans. So as you can imagine, for many employers, this is going to be a huge, huge cost increase in terms of their workforce. So actually, 21 states sued in the Eastern District of Texas, which is what led to the court issuing an injunction last week, which put a hold on this increase in the salary threshold, and there's now a preliminary injunction in effect. And ultimately what the judge found was that there was a substantial likelihood of success and irreparable harm to these employers. And it's not yet been announced whether or not the Department of Labor is going to be appealing that decision. So we're going to have to keep a close eye on this, especially with Trump coming into office as well.
Yeah, that's what we were going to ask you. But we just talked about the effect of President Trump on legalization of marijuana across the country. How do you think this will be affected by the Trump administration?
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of possibilities. I think at the forefront is the possibility that President-elect Trump will direct the Department of Labor either not to appeal the decision or to stand back from any appeal that they've filed at that point. And really the issue in this case is whether or not the Department of Labor has exceeded their authority in increasing the threshold. And what a lot of employers have done in anticipation of this regulation going into effect December 1st, they've already made certain changes. That means they've either reclassified employees who previously were exempt, meaning that they now are going to be getting paid overtime, or they've increased their salaries to hit that threshold so they don't have to worry about overtime. So employers that have already made those changes are left in a tricky situation, whether to backtrack on those changes or whether to keep them into effect. And certainly reducing someone's salary or now saying that they're not going to get paid overtime is not good for morale. So it puts employers in a very tough situation.
Trump hasn't officially come out, I think, and had a position on this particular issue. But, you know, he has been very vocal, of course, in saying that he's going to roll back several Obama administration regulations. He sees that as the key to stimulating economic growth. So I wouldn't be surprised if he does come out, forcefully on this issue.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, he's very into rolling back those regulations, and this would be at the heart of those.
Is there any way that they could go back and do a graduated system where, you know, incremental increases over the next few years?
It's possible, but I don't think that that would be in the appeal of this particular case, because this particular case deals with whether or not the Department of Labor exceeded their authority in defining those salary thresholds. So it's possible that Congress could go in and implement changes, but not the Department of Labor.
Mital, we're going to let you go on this question. We're talking today about famous celebrities that we've all met in the wake of me meeting Bruce Springsteen yesterday. Well, who's the most famous celebrity that Mital Savin, employment and labor guru, has ever met?
That's a good question.
Putting you on the spot with that one. You thought we'd only be talking about exciting overtime regulations, but most famous. You lived in L.A. I mean, you must have ran into a bunch of celebrities back in the day. I think you told me, and I forget who it was. You did tell me you met someone pretty big.
You know,
I forget who it was.
It's so funny. Growing up in L.A., I personally did not pay much attention to it, so I'm trying to think who it was.
No Israeli film superstars?
No, unfortunately not.
All right, well, when we next have you on, you'll have to either think of someone or make someone up.
Yeah, I think the biggest celebrity I met, Rich Lenkoff. That was it.
Oh, jeez. No, yeah.
So that whole setup, two-minute setup for that.
Oh, my God.
Finally.
You guys really botched that script.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was brutal.
How fun will the holiday party be this year? That's the
will
last question.
Like last time?
Are Sam and I required to attend again this year?
This year it's spin. Ping pong.
Oh. Wow, what a shocker.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, before this gets too far off the rails, Mital, we will let you go. We appreciate your time. She's Mital Savin, the labor and employment guru, as Rich said, for Bryce, Downey, and Lenkov. We'll see you soon, Mital. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Legal grab bag time on Legal Face Off. That's how we wrap up every show here on WGN Plus. Rich Lenkov and Jason Whiteside. Seven topics today. We'll roll right through on number one. We start with Rich. The Charleston church shooter represents himself.
Yeah, Dylan Roof, who was a white supremacist accused of murdering nine black parishioners at a Charleston, South Carolina church last year, on Monday began acting as his own lawyer. This is a federal death penalty case, so, you know, serious stuff. Dylan Roof asked Judge Gergel to allow him to represent himself at trial. The judge allowed him to do that, but said that he would recommend that his lawyers help him. But, yeah, you don't see too many examples of someone accused of 33 counts of hate crimes and murder representing themselves. Judges will allow it. You know, the standard is generally if you're competent, if you're able to competently, you know, represent yourself. You don't have to be a lawyer, right? Yeah. I mean, you have the right.
The judges
want to
make
yourself,
sure too that
the judges want.
You're not going to be too big of a distraction to the trial. But
yeah.
Would you ever represent yourself as an attorney? I never would. I mean, absolutely not. It's the most ridiculous thing. You're too emotionally invested in the case.
Yeah, I mean, certainly not for something like this. I mean, you know, we've all probably gone to court on traffic tickets and, you know, we would do that. But, yeah, certainly not something like this. So.
Similar situation. Ned Al Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter. He was his own defense attorney.
How'd it go?
He got the death penalty.
Not so good.
So not so good.
Okay. Here are three words I didn't think I'd ever use on Legal Face Off. Yoga twin murder.
Yeah, and this was a story that was in the news back in May. Twin sisters were driving in a car in Hawaii. Their car went off a cliff, and one of the twins died. And charges were brought forth against the surviving a twin named Allison Dotto. Allison was alleged to commit murder and killing her sister, purposely driving the car off the cliff. But the Maui court threw out the charges. The judge said there was a lack of evidence. However, she left Maui, came back to New York, and another Maui court grand jury convened, and they found enough evidence to charge her with at least second-degree murder. So now she's awaiting extradition to Hawaii from
New York.
Back
to Hawaii, yeah.
Yeah, what a lovely place to spend for prison.
If you got to spend, if you got to be in prison, you know, why
homeless
not,
or prison,
why not
go to
be
Hawaii?
In Hawaii?
We have a PI firm in fighting situation going on in New York.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting story. A big plaintiff's personal injury firm in New York, Napoli and Byrne, involved in scandal. So if I told you there was a story involving sex, prostitutes, Hamptons, lots of money, you'd probably think it's the Real Housewives of New York. But
or
no,
like a new movie.
Yeah, no, it's a...
it's a crazy story. Absolutely crazy story. It's a, I mean, the articles and everything on it are pretty long and lengthy about the history between these two guys, but it all broke down when one of the partners got leukemia and was gone for an extended period of time. The other partner came in, made massive changes to the firm. You know, his allegations about money, divorce, sex, drugs, sleeping with associates. It's a crazy story. But
yeah, Napoli Byrne, they had 80 lawyers, two floors of the Empire State Building. My favorite detail is that both of the named partners, who are now on opposite sides of this litigation, had identical paintings of Superman in their offices.
I'm still getting over the 3,400 square foot apartment and the beam ceilings and the wood-burning fireplace. That's
yeah, they made a, they made a lot of their money on two big cases. Fen-Phen, they represent a ton of Fen-Phen plaintiffs, and also first responders from 9/11 who alleged exposure and fumes after Ground Zero.
Yeah, they're fighting over some 5,400 cases, 5,400 cases that they're fighting
almost
over now.
Almost as big as Whiteside Goldberg.
Yeah, you know, we're just shy of 5,400. but, you know, we had actually covered this story about a year ago. One of the partners slept with an associate, and so the partner's wife filed a lawsuit against the associate. She's now an attorney down in Texas, and it's still going. I mean, there's no – the partner's wife is not letting up. This lawsuit is still moving forward. So that'll be interesting.
Interestingly,
as well.
I mean, one of the interesting things was the judge had to split up their caseload. They had 24,000 clients, and the judge had to go through them and decide, you know, who should stay and who should go with the new firm. So
that's crazy.
Just like, when you thought that you fight with your partners, it doesn't rise to the level of this.
No, no.
So Nick Gordon has been ordered by a judge to pay the family of Bobby Christina Brown at last check $36 million. Do we have anything late on that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the whole hearing, to put it in context, I mean, it was before a judge. There was no jury. The state essentially sued Nick Gordon. There was a finding. Nick Gordon didn't show up. He had criminal attorneys, but no civil attorneys, so no one was there to defend his side of it. And they slapped him with a $36 million lawsuit. So I'm assuming that Nick Gordon does not have the funds to pay a $36 million lawsuit.
Probably not.
It's probably just a paper judgment with no real money behind it. But still a sad story on what took place.
There's a local star chef here in Chicago, Rich, who is headed to jail.
The mayor of Chinatown, he's known as Tony Hu.
Who?
Yes, who? he owns many restaurants here in Chicago. His most famous one is Lao Szechuan, and, you know, while achieving great success, he was doing so at the expense of taxpayers because he owed about 40 – or he was not paying taxes on about $40 million in annual sales. This has actually gone on for a couple of years, but most recently –
His sales tax alone was $1 million a year that he was skirting on to Illinois.
He was trying to hide $10 million.
That's like 8% or 9% of his total gross. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, he admitted. I mean, he said in court last week that he felt shame for what he did. But I mean, basically, the feds bursted in on his home.
In his living room. His living room has like people cooking books.
Yeah.
That's what they were doing.
The prosecutor called it an assembly line. Of tax evasion. He had two sets of books, one he kept for his business and one that was really what was going on. There were three piles of receipts in his living room. So there was records on his couch waiting to be doctored. There was another pile of records already altered with handwritten figures that grossly underreported his earnings. And then there was a third pile for receipts and reports for his managers to destroy.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
you just
crazy.
Can't make this stuff up.
But
so.
I love his defense. His attorneys had said that, hey, this was how he was trained. And when he took over the restaurant, he just thought what you do.
You should have said so then.
Yeah.
You're
just supposed to underreport your income. That's normal.
There was 100 garbage bags filled with receipts that the feds took away. And Judge Amy St. Eve is the one who sentenced him to a year and a day.
So he has a half dozen restaurants in Chinatown. He's also in Vegas, San Francisco, L.A. His real name, though, is not Tony Hu.
No.
No?
What is it,
That changes everything
for
me.
Can you pronounce it?
It is, his first name is Hu, and his last name is spelled X-I-A-O-J-U-N.
You know what his new name is?
Xiao Zhen, I believe.
Do you know what his new name is?
6-1-0-9-2.
I got two answers. I got that answer or Sweetie.
Yeah.
Two more here on Legal Grab Bag. Bethany Frankel has not had the best week.
No, she's filed a lawsuit against her real estate attorney. Apparently, when she was married to her husband, Jason Hoppe, they put a trust together to purchase a condo. And the trust was to keep her, basically a blind trust to keep her information private. And the trust was only supposed to be in her name since she put down a substantial amount for the down payment. And so she filed suit because it was put in her and her former husband's name. And her husband said, well, he's still entitled to some of the money from the sale of the condo because he paid for some maintenance fees and taxes on it. So she had sued the attorney under a legal malpractice theory, alleging that he improperly put the trust together and established it in both their names when it should have just been in her name.
Former Apprentice contestant, by the way.
Who, Bethany?
Bethany Frankel.
Oh, really?
The Apprentice Martha Stewart version. Yes.
Was that a
all
real
comes
thing?
Comes back to Trump. Yeah, there was a season where
there was like a Snoop Dogg joke or a...
No, there was a spinoff with Martha Stewart and Bethany was a contestant. Anyway.
We talked about legalizing marijuana. These are now legal.
Yeah.
Cuban cigars.
Yeah, in the wake of the death of Fidel Castro, actually it has no relation. The ban was lifted a few months ago by Obama. So
they still can't be sold here in the U.S. Just make that distinction known. They can't be sold here, but they can be brought in.
Well, they
from
can't be
Cuba.
Sold legally.
Right. Well, yeah, they're still sold illegally. But there's a great article on how to tell a Cuban versus a fake, since there's a lot of fakes that are out there. But you can legally now bring in 100 Cuban cigars into the United States.
What if you have 101? What happens?
I really don't think they'll bother you. I mean, it's not that big of a deal.
Much easier now than back in the days when Jason would take a clandestine flight overnight to Havana. And then
I would book a yacht and charter it down.
Fill his torso.
No,
you swim
one mile. Out of the plane.
Fill your person with all sorts of
illegal
contraband.
Have guns in the hills to shoot those planes down in Cuba.
Are you either of you guys cigar smokers?
I'm not.
I do, yeah. I was in Cuba and partook in a few cigars.
And you
cigars
can tell
too.
The difference between a Cuban and a Dominican cigar.
Yeah.
We're talking about.
I did say cigar, didn't I?
Yeah.
Oh.
All right, last question. Most famous person you ever met? Quickly. I met Springsteen yesterday. Sam, you've met a million famous
Michael Jordan
athletes.
Still does it for me.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I mean,
Whiteside? I don't know. I mean, I met some athletes. A guy that I grew up with was Nick Offerman. So, I mean, I've known him.
Yeah, you brought the whole room down with the Nick Offerman. As the most famous. We got Jordan, Springsteen, Nick Offerman.
I think Nick Offerman's hilarious.
But I mean, I know him. It's not like I...
Waterco, what do you got?
You've
met everyone. I hugged him in a photo.
Clearly, the most famous person I've ever met is Rich Lincoln.
Yeah. Good night.
Good night,
everybody. Chicago.
That credit card must have gone through for Rich and not Jason.
Thank you, our guests. Thank you for listening. We'll see you in 2 weeks on Legal Face-Up.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.